large hand on my shoulder and moving me to the window.
I don't know one from the other. Who's the spider?
The spider? Said I.
The blotchy, sprawly, sulky fellow.
Well, that's Bentley Drummle, I replied. The one with the delicate face is Startop. Not making the least account of the one with the delicate face, he returned,
Bentley Drummle is his name, is it? I like the look of that fellow.
He immediately began to talk to Drummle, not at all deterred by his replying in his heavy, reticent way, but apparently led on by it to screw discourse out of him. I was looking at the two when there came between me and them the housekeeper with the first dish for the table. She was a woman of about 40, I supposed, but I may have thought her younger than she was. Rather tall, of a lithe, nimble figure, extremely pale, with large faded eyes and a quantity of streaming hair. I cannot say whether any diseased affection of the heart caused her lips to be parted as if she were panting, and her face to bear a curious expression of suddenness and flutter. But I know that I had been to see Macbeth at the theatre a night or two before, and that her face looked to me as if it were all disturbed by fiery air, like the faces I had seen rise out of the witch's cauldron. She set the dish on, touched my guardian quietly on the arm, with a finger to notify that dinner was ready, and vanished. We took our seats at the round table, and my guardian kept Drummle on one side of him, while Startop sat on the other. It was a noble dish of fish that the housekeeper had put on the table, and we had a joint of equally choice mutton afterwards, and then an equally choice bird. Sauces, wines, all the accessories we wanted, and all the best, were given out by our host from his dumb waiter, and when they had made the circuit of the table, he always put them back again. Similarly, he dealt us clean plates and knives and forks for each course, and dropped those just disused into two baskets on the ground by his chair. No other attendant than the housekeeper appeared. She sat on every dish, and I always saw in her face a face rising out of the cauldron. Years afterwards, I made a dreadful likeness of that woman by causing a face that had no other natural resemblance to it than it derived from flowing hair to pass behind a bowl of flaming spirits in a dark room. Induced to take particular notice of the housekeeper, both by her own striking appearance and by Wemmick's preparation, I observed that whenever she was in the room, she kept her eyes attentively on my guardian, and that she would remove her hands from any dish she put before him, hesitatingly, as if she dreaded his calling her back, and wanted him to speak when she was nigh, if he had anything to say. I fancied that I could detect in his manner a consciousness of this, and a purpose of always holding her in suspense. Dinner went off gaily, and although my guardian seemed to follow rather than originate subjects, I knew that he wrenched the weakest part of our disposition out of us. For myself, I found that I was expressing my tendency to lavish expenditure, and to patronize Herbert, and to boast of my great prospects, before I quite knew that I had opened my lips. It was so with all of us, but with no one more than Drummle, the development of whose inclination to gird in a grudging and suspicious way at the rest was screwed out of him before the fish was taken off. It was not then, but when we got to the cheese, that our conversation turned upon our rowing feats, and that Drummle was rallied for coming up behind of a night in that slow amphibious way of his. Drummle, upon this, informed our host that he much preferred our room to our company, and that as to skill, he was more than our master, and that as to strength, he could scatter us like chaff. By some invisible agency, my guardian wound him up to a pitch little short of ferocity about this trifle, and he fell to bearing and spanning his arm to show how muscular it was, and we all fell to bearing and spanning our arms in a ridiculous manner. Now the housekeeper was at that time clearing the table. My guardian, taking no heed of her, but with the side of his face turned from her, was leaning back in his chair, biting the side of his forefinger, and showing an interest in Drummle that to me was quite inexplicable. Suddenly he clapped his large hand on the housekeeper's like a trap as she stretched it across the table. So suddenly and smartly did he do this that we all stopped in our foolish contention.
"If you talk of strength," said Mr. Jaggers, "I'll show you a wrist. Molly, let them see your wrist."
Her entrapped hand was on the table, but she had already put her other hand behind her waist.
"Master,"
she said in a low voice, with her eyes attentively and entreatingly fixed upon him.
"Don't. I'll show you a wrist," repeated Mr. Jaggers, with an immovable determination to show it. "Molly, let them see your wrist."
"Master," she again murmured, "please."
"Molly,"
said Mr. Jaggers, not looking at her, but obstinately looking at the opposite side of the room.
"Let them see both your wrists. Show them. Come."
He took her hand from hers and turned that wrist up on the table. She brought her other hand from behind her and held the two out side by side. The last wrist was much disfigured, deeply scarred and scarred across and across. When she held her hands out, she took her eyes from Mr. Jaggers and turned them watchfully on every one of the rest of us in succession.
"There's power here,"
said Mr. Jaggers, coolly tracing out the sinews with his forefinger.
"Very few men have the power of wrist that this woman has. It's remarkable what mere force of grip there is in these hands. I've had occasion to notice many hands, but I never saw stronger in that respect, man's or woman's, than these."
While he said these words in a leisurely, critical style, she continued to look at every one of us in regular succession as we sat. The moment he ceased, she looked at him again.
"That'll do, Molly,"
said Mr. Jaggers, giving her a slight nod.
"You've been admired, and can go."
She withdrew her hands and went out of the room. Mr. Jaggers, putting the decanters on from his dumb waiter, filled his glass and passed round the wine.
"At 9:30, gentlemen," said he, "we must break up. Pray make the best use of your time. I'm glad to see you all. Mr. Drummle, I drink to you."
If his object in singling out Drummle were to bring him out still more, it perfectly succeeded. In a sulky triumph, Drummle showed his morose depreciation of the rest of us in a more and more offensive degree, until he became downright intolerable. Through all his stages, Mr. Jaggers followed him with the same strange interest. He actually seemed to serve as a zest to Mr. Jaggers' wine. In our boyish want of discretion, I dare say we took too much to drink, and I know we talked too much. We became particularly hot upon some boorish sneer of Drummle's, to the effect that we were too free with our money. It led to my remarking, with more zeal than discretion, that it came with a bad grace from him, to whom Startop had lent money in my presence but a week or so before.
"Well," retorted Drummle, "he'll be paid."
"I don't mean to imply that he won't," said I, "but it might make you hold your tongue about us and our money, I should think."
"You should think," retorted Drummle. "Oh, Lord!"
"I dare say," I went on, meaning to be very severe, "that you wouldn't lend money to any of us if we wanted it."
"You're right," said Drummle. "I wouldn't lend one of you a sixpence. I wouldn't lend anybody a sixpence."
"Rather mean to borrow under those circumstances, I should say."
"You should say," repeated Drummle. "Oh, Lord!"
This was so very aggravating, the more especially as I found myself making no way against his surly obtuseness, that I said, disregarding Herbert's efforts to check me,
"Come, Mr. Drummle, since we're on the subject, I'll tell you what passed between Herbert here and me when you borrowed that money."
"I don't want to know what passed between Herbert there and you," growled Drummle,
and I think he added in a lower growl that we might both go to the devil and shake ourselves.
"I'll tell you, however," said I, "whether you want to know or not. We said that as you put it into your pocket, very glad to get it, you seemed to be immensely amused at his being so weak as to lend it."
Drummle laughed outright, and sat laughing in our faces with his hands in his pockets and his round shoulders raised, plainly signifying that it was quite true and that he despised us as asses all. Hereupon Startop took him in hand, though with a much better grace than I had shown, and exhorted him to be a little more agreeable. Startop being a lively, bright young fellow, and Drummle being the exact opposite, the latter was always disposed to resent him as a direct personal affront. He now retorted in a coarse, lumpish way, and Startop tried to turn the discussion aside with some small pleasantry that made us all laugh. Resenting this little success more than anything, Drummle, without any threat or warning, pulled his hands out of his pockets, dropped his round shoulders, swore, took up a large glass, and would have flung it at his adversary's head but for our entertainers dexterously seizing it at the instant when it was raised for that purpose.
"Gentlemen," said Mr. Jaggers, deliberately putting down the glass and hauling out his gold repeater by its massive chain, "I am exceedingly sorry to announce that it's 9:30.
On this hint, we all rose to depart. Before we got to the street door, Startop was cheerily calling Drummle old boy, as if nothing had happened. But the old boy was so far from responding that he would not even walk to Hammersmith on the same side of the way. So Herbert and I, who remained in town, saw them going down the street on opposite sides, Startop leading and Drummle lagging behind in the shadow of the houses, much as he was wont to follow in his boat. As the door was not yet shut, I thought I would leave Herbert there for a moment and run upstairs again to say a word to my guardian. I found him in his dressing-room, surrounded by his stock of boots, already hard at it, washing his hands of us. I told him I had come up again to say how sorry I was that anything disagreeable should have occurred, and that I hoped he would not blame me much.
"Pooh,"
said he, sluicing his face and speaking through the water drops.
"That's nothing, Pip. I like that spider, though."
He had turned towards me now, and was shaking his head, and blowing and toweling himself.
"I'm glad you like him, sir," said I. "But I don't."
"No, no," my guardian assented. "Don't have too much to do with him. Keep as clear of him as you can. But I like the fellow, Pip. He is one of the true sort. Why, if I was a fortune-teller—"
Looking out of the towel, he caught my eye.
"But I am not a fortune-teller," he said, letting his head drop into a festoon of towel and toweling away at his own ears. "You know what I am, don't you? Good night, Pip."
"Good night, sir." In about a month after that, the spider's time with Mr. Pocket was up for good, and to the great relief of all the house but Mrs. Pocket, he went home to the family hole. Chapter 27.
"My dear Mr. Pip, I write this by request of Mr. Gardrey, for to let you know that he's going to London in company with Mr. Wopsle, and would be glad, if agreeable, to be allowed to see you. He would call at Barnard's Hotel Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock, when, if not agreeable, please leave word. Your poor sister is much the same as when you left. We talk of you in the kitchen every night, and wonder what you are saying and doing. If now considered in the light of a liberty, excuse it for the love of poor old days. No more, dear Mr. Pip, from your ever obliged and affectionate servant, Biddy. P.S. He wishes me most particular to write 'What Larks.' He says you will understand. I hope and do not doubt it will be agreeable to see him, even though a gentleman, for you had ever a good heart, and he is a worthy, worthy man. I have read him all, excepting only the last little sentence, and he wishes me most particular to write again, 'What Larks.'"
I received this letter by post on Monday morning, and therefore its appointment was for next day. Let me confess exactly with what feelings I looked forward to Joe's coming. Not with pleasure, though I was bound to him by so many ties. No, with considerable disturbance, some mortification, and a keen sense of incongruity. If I could have kept him away by paying money, I certainly would have paid money. My greatest reassurance was that he was coming to Barnard's Inn, not to Hammersmith, and consequently would not fall in Bentley Drummle's way. I had little objection to his being seen by Herbert or his father, for both of whom I had a respect, but I had the sharpest sensitiveness as to his being seen by Drummle, whom I held in contempt. So throughout life, our worst weaknesses and meannesses are usually committed for the sake of the people whom we most despise. I had begun to be always decorating the chambers in some quite unnecessary and inappropriate way or other, and very expensive those wrestles with Barnard proved to be. By this time the rooms were vastly different from what I had found them, and I enjoyed the honour of occupying a few prominent pages in the books of a neighbouring upholsterer. I had got on so fast of late that I had even started a boy in boots, top boots, in bondage and slavery, to whom I might be said to pass my days. For after I had made this monster out of the refuse of my washerwoman's family, and had clothed him with a blue coat, canary waistcoat, white cravat, creamy breeches, and the boots already mentioned, I had to find him a little to do, and a great deal to eat, and with both of those horrible requirements he haunted my existence. This avenging phantom was ordered to be on duty at 8 on Tuesday morning in the hall. It was 2 feet square, as charged for floorcloth, and Herbert suggested certain things for breakfast that he thought Joe would like. While I felt sincerely obliged to him for being so interested and considerate, I had an odd half-provoked sense of suspicion upon me that if Joe had been coming to see him, he wouldn't have been quite so brisk about it. However, I came into town on the Monday night to be ready for Joe, and I got up early in the morning and caused the sitting-room and breakfast-table to assume their most splendid appearance. Unfortunately, the morning was drizzly, and an angel could not have concealed the fact that Barnard was shedding sooty tears outside the window like some weak giant of a sweep. As the time approached, I should have liked to run away, but the Avenger, pursuant to orders, was in the hall, and presently I heard Joe on the staircase. I knew it was Joe, by his clumsy manner of coming upstairs, his state boots being always too big for him, and by the time it took him to read the names on the other floors in the course of his ascent. When at last he stopped outside our door, I could hear his finger tracing over the painted letters of my name, and I afterwards distinctly heard him breathing in at the keyhole. Finally, he gave a faint single rap, and Pepper, such was the compromising name of the avenging boy, announced, "Mr. Gorgery!" I thought he would never have done wiping his feet, and that I must have gone out to lift him off the mat, but at last he came in. "Joe, how are you, Joe?"
"Pep, how are you, Pep?"
With his good honest face all glowing and shining, and his hat put down on the floor between us, he caught both my hands and worked them straight up and down, as if I'd been the last patented pump.
"I am glad to see you, Joe. Give me your hat."
But Joe, taking it up carefully with both hands like a bird's nest with eggs in it, wouldn't hear of parting with that piece of property, and persisted in standing talking over it in a most uncomfortable way.
"Which you have that growed," said Joe, "and that swelled, and that gentlefolk."
Joe considered a little before discovering this word.
"As to be sure you are an honour to your king and country.
And you, Joe, look wonderfully well."
"Thank God," said Joe. "I'm equivalent to most, and your sister, she's no worse than she were, and Biddy, she's ever right and ready, and all friends is no backarder or no forwarder, except in Wopsle. He's had a drop."
All this time, still with both hands taking great care of the bird's nest, Joe was rolling his eyes round and round the room, and round the flowered pattern of my dressing gown.
"Had a drop, Joe?"
"Why, yes," said Joe, lowering his voice. "He's left the church and went into the play-acting, which the play-acting have likewise brought him to London, along with me. And his wish were," said Joe,
getting the bird's nest under his left arm for the moment and groping in it for an egg with his right,
"if no offence, as I would hand you that."
I took what Joe gave me and found it to be a crumpled playbill of a small metropolitan theatre announcing the first appearance in that very week of the celebrated provincial amateur of Rossian renown, whose unique performance in the highest tragic walk of our national bard has lately occasioned so great a sensation in local dramatic circles.
"Were you at his performance, Joe?" I inquired.
"I were," said Joe, with emphasis and solemnity.
"Was there a great sensation?"
"Why," said Joe, "yes, there certainly were a peck of orange peel, particularly when he sees the ghost, though I put it to you yourself, sir, whether it were calculated to keep a man up with his work with a good heart, to be continually cutting in betwixt him and the ghost with amen. A man may have had a misfortune and been in the church," said Joe, lowering his voice to an argumentative and feeling tone, "but that is no reason why you should put him out this such time, which I mean to say, if the ghost of a man's own father
cannot be allowed to claim his attention. What can, sir? Still more, when his mourning hat is unfortunately made so small as the weight of the black feathers brings it off. Try to keep it on how you may.
A ghost-seeing effect in Joe's own countenance informed me that Herbert had entered the room. So I presented Joe to Herbert, who held out his hand, but Joe backed from it and held on by the bird's nest.
"Your servant, sir," said Joe, "which I hope is you and Pip."
Here his eye fell on the Avenger, who was putting some toast on table, and so plainly denoted an intention to make that young gentleman one of the family, that I frowned it down and confused him more.
"I mean to say you two gentlemen, which I hope as you get your healths in this close spot. For the present may be a very good inn according to London opinions," said Joe confidentially, "and I believe its character do stand I, but I wouldn't keep a pig in it myself. Not in the case that I wished them to fatten wholesome, and to eat with a mellow flavour on them."
Having borne this flattering testimony to the merits of our dwelling-place, and having incidentally shown this tendency to call me sir, Joe, being invited to sit down to table, looked all round the room for a suitable spot on which to deposit his hat, as if it were only on some few very rare substances in nature that it could find a resting-place, and ultimately stood it on an extreme corner of the chimney-piece from which it ever afterwards fell off at intervals.
"Do you take tea or coffee, Mr. Gargery?" asked Herbert, who always presided of a morning. "Thank ye, sir," said Joe, stiff from head to foot. "I'll take whichever is most agreeable to yourself. What do you say to coffee?" "Thank ye, sir," returned Joe, evidently dispirited by the proposal. "Since you are so kind as to make a choice of coffee, I will not run contrary to your own opinions. But don't you never find it a little eating?"
"Say tea, then," said Herbert, pouring it out.
Here Joe's hat tumbled off the mantelpiece, and he started out of his chair and picked it up and fitted it to the same exact spot, as if it were an absolute point of good breeding that it should tumble off again soon.
"When did you come to town, Mr. Gargery?"
"Were it yesterday afternoon?"
said Joe, after coughing behind his hand, as if he had had time to catch the whooping cough since he came.
No, it were not. Yes, it were. Yes, it were yesterday afternoon,"
with an appearance of mingled wisdom, relief, and strict impartiality.
"Have you seen anything of London yet?"
"Why, yes, sir," said Joe. "Me and Wopsle went off straight to look at the Black and Werris, but we didn't find that it come up to its likeness in the red bills at the shop doors, which I mean to say," added Joe in an explanatory manner, "as it is there drawed to architectural laurel."
I really believe Joe would have prolonged this word, mightily expressive to my mind of some architecture that I know, into a perfect chorus, but for his attention being providentially attracted by his hat, which was toppling. Indeed, it demanded from him a constant attention and a quickness of eye and hand, very like that exacted by wicket-keeping. He made extraordinary play with it, and showed the greatest skill, now rushing at it and catching it neatly as it dropped, now merely stopping it midway, beating it up and humouring it in various parts of the room and against a good deal of the pattern of the paper on the wall, before he felt it safe to close with it, finally splashing it into the slop-basin, where I took the liberty of laying hands upon it. As to his shirt-collar and his coat-collar, they were perplexing to reflect upon, insoluble mysteries both. Why should a man scrape himself to that extent before he would consider himself fully dressed? Why should he suppose it necessary to be purified by suffering for his holiday clothes? Then he fell into such unaccountable fits of meditation, with his fork midway between his plate and his mouth, had his eyes attracted in such strange directions, was afflicted with such remarkable coughs, sat so far from the table and dropped so much more than he ate, and pretended that he hadn't dropped it, that I was heartily glad when Herbert left us for the city. I had neither the good sense nor the good feeling to know that this was all my fault, and that if I had been easier with Joe, Joe would have been easier with me. I felt impatient of him, and out of temper with him, in which condition he heaped coals of fire on my head.
"Us two being now alone, sir," began Joe.
"Joe," I interrupted pettishly, "how can you call me sir?"
Joe looked at me for a single instant, with something faintly like reproach. Utterly preposterous as his cravat was, and as his collars were, I was conscious of a sort of dignity in the look.
"Us two being now alone," resumed Joe, "and me having the intentions and abilities to stay not many minutes more, I will now conclude, leastways begin, to mention what have led to my having had the present honour. For it was not," said Joe with his old air of lucid exposition, "that my only wish were to be useful to you, I should not have had the honour of breaking wittles in the company and abode of gentlemen."
I was so unwilling to see the look again that I made no remonstrance against this tone.
"Well, sir," pursued Joe, "this is how it were. I were at the bargeman t'other night, Pip."
Whenever he subsided into affection, he called me Pip, and whenever he relapsed into politeness, he called me Sir.
"When there come up in his shay-cart Pumblechook, which that same identical," said Joe, going down a new track, "do comb my hair the wrong way sometimes, awful, by giving out and up and down town as it were him, which ever had your infant companionation, and were looked upon as a playfellow by yourself."
"Nonsense, it was you, Joe."
"Which I fully believed it were, Pip,"
said Joe, slightly tossing his head, "though it signify little now, sir.
Well, Pip, this same identical, which his manners is given to blusterous, come to me at the bargeman. What a pipe and a pint of beer do give refreshment to the working man, sir, and do not overstimulate. And his word were, 'Joseph, Miss Havisham, she wish to speak to you.'"
"Miss Havisham, Joe?"
"She wish," were Pumblechook's word, "to speak to you."
Joe sat and rolled his eyes at the ceiling.
"Well, yes, Joe. Go on, please." "Well, next day, sir," said Joe, looking at me as if I were a long way off, "having cleaned myself, I go and I see Miss A."
"Miss A, Joe? Miss Havisham?"
"Which I say, sir," replied Joe, with an air of legal formality, as if he were making his will. "Miss A, or otherwise Havisham, her expression ere then is following. 'Mr. Gardry, you air in correspondence with Mr. Pip?' 'Having had a letter from you, I were able to say I am. When I married your sister, sir, I said, I will. And when I answered your friend, Pip, I said, I am.' 'Would you tell him then,' said she, 'that which Estella has come home, and would be glad to see him?'"
I felt my face fire up as I looked at Joe. I hope one remote cause of its firing may have been in my consciousness that if I had known his errand, I should have given him more encouragement.
"Betty," pursued Joe, "when I got home and asked for her to write the message to you, a little hung back. Betty says, 'I know he will be very glad to have it by word of mouth. It's holiday time. You want to see him? Go.'"
"I've now concluded, sir," said Joe, rising from his chair.
"And, Pip, I wish you ever well and ever prospering to a greater and greater height."
"But you're not going now, Joe?"
"Yes, I am," said Joe.
"But you're coming back to dinner, Joe?"
"No, I am not," said Joe.
Our eyes met, and all the sir melted out of that manly heart as he gave me his hand.
"Pip, dear old chap, life is made of ever so many partings welded together, as I may say, and one man's a blacksmith, and one's a whitesmith, and one's a goldsmith, and one's a coppersmith. Divisions among such must come, and must be met as they come. If there's been any fault at all today, it's mine. You and me is not two figures to be together in London, nor yet anywheres else but what is private and beknown and understood among friends. It ain't that I'm proud, but that I want to be right, as you shall never see me no more in these clothes. I'm wrong in these clothes. I'm wrong out of the forge, the kitchen, or off the meshes. You won't find half so much fault in me if you think of me in my forge dress, with my hammer in my hand, or even my pipe. You won't find half so much fault in me if, supposing as you should ever wish to see me, you come and put your head in at the forge window, and see Joe the blacksmith there, at the old anvil, and the old burnt apron sticking to the old work. I'm awful dull, but I hope I've beat out something nigh the rights of this at last. And so, God bless you, dear old Pip, old chap. God bless you.
I had not been mistaken in my fancy that there was a simple dignity in him. The fashion of his dress could no more come in its way when he spoke these words than it would come in its way in heaven. He touched me gently on the forehead and went out. As soon as I could recover myself sufficiently, I hurried out after him and looked for him in the neighbouring streets. But he was gone.
Chapter 28. It was clear that I must repair to our town next day, and in the first flow of my repentance it was equally clear that I must stay at Joe's. But when I had secured my box place by tomorrow's coach and had been down to Mr. Pocket's and back, I was not by any means convinced on the last point, and began to invent reasons and make excuses for putting up at the Blue Boar. I should be an inconvenience at Joe's. I was not expected, and my bed would not be ready. I should be too far from Miss Havisham's, and she was exacting and mightn't like it. All other swindlers upon earth are nothing to the self-swindlers, and with such pretences did I cheat myself. Surely a curious thing, that I should innocently take a bad half-crown of somebody else's manufacture is reasonable enough, but that I should knowingly reckon on the spurious coin of my own make as good money. An obliging stranger, under pretense of compactly folding up my banknotes for security's sake, abstracts the notes and gives me nutshells. But what is his sleight of hand to mine, when I fold up my own nutshells and pass them on myself as notes? Having settled that I must go to the Blue Boar, my mind was much disturbed by indecision whether or no to take the Avenger. It was tempting to think of that expensive mercenary publicly airing his boots in the archway of the Blue Boar's posting yard. It was almost solemn to imagine him casually produced in the tailor's shop and confounding the disrespectful senses of Trabb's boy. On the other hand, Trabb's boy might worm himself into his intimacy and tell him things. Or, reckless and desperate wretch as I knew he could be, might hoot him in the high street. My patroness, too, might hear of him and not approve. On the whole, I resolved to leave the Avenger behind. It was the afternoon coach by which I had taken my place, and as winter had now come round, I should not arrive at my destination until 2 or 3 hours after dark. Our time of starting from the Cross Keys was 2 o'clock. I arrived on the ground with a quarter of an hour to spare, attended by the Avenger, if I may connect that expression with one who never attended on me if he could possibly help it. At that time, it was customary to carry convicts down to the dockyards by stagecoach, as I had often heard of them in the capacity of outside passengers, and had more than once seen them on the high road dangling their iron legs over the coach roof. I had no cause to be surprised when Herbert, meeting me in the yard, came up and told me there were 2 convicts going down with me. But I had a reason that was an old reason now for constitutionally faltering whenever I heard the word convict. "You don't mind them, Handel?" said Herbert. "Oh, no. I thought you seemed as if you didn't like them. I can't pretend that I do like them, and I suppose you don't particularly, but I don't mind them. See, there they are," said Herbert, "coming out of the tap. What a degraded and vile sight it is." They had been treating their guard, I suppose, for they had a jailer with them, and all 3 came out wiping their mouths on their hands. The 2 convicts were handcuffed together and had irons on their legs, irons of a pattern that I knew well. They wore the dress that I likewise knew well. Their keeper had a brace of pistols and carried a thick-knobbed bludgeon under his arm, but he was on terms of good understanding with them, and stood, with them beside him, looking on at the putting to of the horses, rather with an air as if the convicts were an interesting exhibition not formally open at the moment, and he the curator. One was a taller and stouter man than the other, and appeared, as a matter of course, according to the mysterious ways of the world, both convict and free, to have had allotted to him the smallest suit of clothes. His arms and legs were like great pincushions of those shapes, and his attire disguised him absurdly. but I knew his half-closed eye at one glance. There stood the man whom I had seen on the settle at the Three Jolly Bargemen on a Saturday night, and who had brought them down with his invisible gun. It was easy to make sure that, as yet, he knew me no more than if he had never seen me in his life. He looked across at me, and his eye appraised my watch-chain, and then he incidentally spat and said something to the other convict, and they laughed and slewed themselves round with a clink of their coupling manacle, and looked at something else. The great numbers on their backs, as if they were street doors, their coarse, mangy, ungainly outer surface, as if they were lower animals, their iron legs apologetically garlanded with pocket handkerchiefs, and the way in which all present looked at them and kept from them, made them, as Herbert had said, a most disagreeable and degraded spectacle. But this was not the worst of it. It came out that the whole of the back of the coach had been taken by a family removing from London, and that there were no places for the two prisoners but on the seat in front, behind the coachman. Hereupon, a choleric gentleman who had taken the fourth place on that seat flew into a most violent passion, and said that it was a breach of contract to mix him up with such villainous company, and that it was poisonous and pernicious and infamous and shameful, and I don't know what else. At this time the coach was ready and the coachman impatient, and we were all preparing to get up, and the prisoners had come over with their keeper, bringing with them that curious flavour of bread poultice, baize, rope yarn, and hearthstone which attends the convict presence.
"Don't take it so much amiss, sir," pleaded the keeper to the angry passenger. "I'll sit next to you myself. I'll put them on the outside of the row. They won't interfere with you, sir. You needn't know they're there."
"Then don't blame me," growled the convict I had recognised. "I don't want to go. I'm quite ready to stay behind. As far as I'm concerned, anyone's welcome to my place."
"Or mine," said the other gruffly. "I wouldn't have incommoded none of you if I'd had my way."
Then they both laughed and began cracking nuts and spitting the shells about, as I really think I should have liked to do myself if I'd been in their place and so despised. At length it was voted that there was no help for the angry gentleman, and that he must either go in his chance of company or remain behind. So he got into his place, still making complaints, and the keeper got into the place next to him, and the convicts hauled themselves up as well as they could, and the convict I had recognised sat behind me, with his breath on the hair of my head.
"Goodbye, Handel,"
Herbert called out as we started. I thought what a blessed fortune it was that he had found another name for me than Pip. It is impossible to express with what acuteness I felt the convict's breathing, not only on the back of my head, but all along my spine. The sensation was like being touched in the marrow with some pungent and searching acid, and it set my very teeth on edge. He seemed to have more breathing business to do than another man, and to make more noise in doing it, and I was conscious of growing high-shouldered on one side in my shrinking endeavours to fend him off. The weather was miserably raw, and the two cursed the cold. It made us all lethargic before we had gone far, and when we had left the halfway house behind, we habitually dozed and shivered and were silent. I dozed off myself in considering the question whether I ought to restore a couple of pounds sterling to this creature before losing sight of him, and how it could best be done. In the act of dipping forward, as if I were going to bathe among the horses, I woke in a fright and took the question up again. But I must have lost it longer than I had thought, since although I could recognise nothing in the darkness and the fitful lights and shadows of our lamps, I traced marsh country in the cold damp wind that blew at us. Cowering forward for warmth and to make me a screen against the wind, the convicts were closer to me than before. The very first words I heard them interchange, as I became conscious, were the words of my own thought.
2 1-pound notes.
"How did he get 'em?"
said the convict I had never seen.
"How should I know?" returned the other. "He had them stowed away somehows. Give him by friends, I expect."
"I wish," said the other with a bitter curse upon the cold, "that I had him here."
2 1-pound notes or friends?"
2 1-pound notes. I'd sell all the friends I'd ever had for one, and I think it's a blessed good bargain. Well, so he says."
"So he says," resumed the convict I had recognised. "It was all said and done in half a minute, behind a pile of timber in the dockyard. You're going to be discharged." "Yes, I was." Would I find out that boy that had fed him and kept his secret, and give him the 2 1-pound notes? Yes, I would, and I did.
More fool you, growled the other. I'd have spent them on a man in wittles and drink. He must have been a green one. Mean to say he knowed nothing of you?
Not a ha'porth. Different gangs and different ships. He was tried again for prison breaking, and he got a lifer.
And was that, honour, the only time you worked out in this part of the country?
The only time.
What might have been your opinion of the place?
A most beastly place. Mudbank, mist, swamp and work. Work, swamp, mist and mudbank.
They both execrated the place in very strong language, and gradually growled themselves out, and had nothing left to say. After overhearing this dialogue, I should assuredly have got down and been left in the solitude and darkness of the highway, but for feeling certain that the man had no suspicion of my identity. Indeed, I was not only so changed in the course of nature, but so differently dressed and so differently circumstanced, that it was not at all likely he could have known me without accidental help. Still, the coincidence of our being together on the coach was sufficiently strange to fill me with a dread that some other coincidence might at any moment connect me, in his hearing, with my name. For this reason, I resolved to alight as soon as we touched the town and put myself out of his hearing. This device I executed successfully. My little portmanteau was in the boot under my feet. I had but to turn a hinge to get it out. I threw it down before me, got down after it, and was left at the first lamp on the first stones of the town pavement. As to the convicts, they went their way with the coach, and I knew at what point they would be spirited off to the river. In my fancy, I saw the boat with its convict crew waiting for them at the slime-washed stairs. Again heard the gruff,
"Give way, you!"
like an order to dogs. Again saw the wicked Noah's Ark lying out on the black water. I could not have said what I was afraid of, for my fear was altogether undefined and vague, but there was a great fear upon me. As I walked on to the hotel, I felt that a dread, much exceeding the mere apprehension of a painful or disagreeable recognition, made me tremble. I am confident that it took no distinctness of shape, and that it was the revival for a few minutes of the terror of childhood. The coffee room at the Blue Boar was empty, and I had not only ordered my dinner there, but had sat down to it, before the waiter knew me. As soon as he had apologized for the remissness of his memory, he asked me if he should send boots for Mr. Pumblechook. No, said I. Certainly not. The waiter, it was he who had brought up the great remonstrance from the commercials on the day when I was bound, appeared surprised, and took the earliest opportunity of putting a dirty old copy of a local newspaper so directly in my way that I took it up and read this paragraph.
Our readers will learn, not altogether without interest, in reference to the recent romantic rise and fortune of a young artificer in iron of this neighbourhood. What a theme, by the way, for the magic pen of our as-yet-not-universally-acknowledged townsman, Tooby, the poet of our columns, that the youth's earliest patron, companion and friend, was a highly respected individual not entirely unconnected with the corn and seed trade, and whose eminently convenient and commodious business premises are situate within 100 miles of the High Street. It is not wholly irrespective of our personal feelings that we record him as the mentor of our young Telemachus, for it is good to know that our town produced the founder of the latter's fortunes. Does the thought-contracted brow of the local sage, or the lustrous eye of the local beauty, inquire whose fortunes? We believe that Quintin Matzes was the blacksmith of Antwerp. Verb, sap. I entertain a conviction, based upon large experience, that if in the days of my prosperity I had gone to the North Pole, I should have met somebody there, wandering Eskimo or civilized man, who would have told me that Pumblechook was my earliest patron and the founder of my fortunes.
Chapter 29. Betimes in the morning I was up and out. It was too early yet to go to Miss Havisham's, so I loitered into the country on Miss Havisham's side of town, which was not Joe's side. I could go there tomorrow. Thinking about my patroness and painting brilliant pictures of her plans for me. She had adopted Estella. She had as good as adopted me, and it could not fail to be her intention to bring us together. She reserved it for me to restore the desolate house, admit the sunshine into the dark rooms, set the clocks a-going and the cold hearths a-blazing, tear down the cobwebs, destroy the vermin. In short, do all the shining deeds of the young knight of romance, and marry the princess. I had stopped to look at the house as I passed, and its seared red brick walls, blocked windows, and strong green ivy, clasping even the stacks of chimneys with its twigs and tendons, as if with sinewy old arms, had made up a rich, attractive mystery, of which I was the hero. Estella was the inspiration of it, and the heart of it, of course. But though she had taken such strong possession of me, though my fancy and my hope were so set upon her, though her influence on my boyish life and character had been all-powerful, I did not, even that romantic morning, invest her with any attributes save those she possessed. I mention this in this place of a fixed purpose, because it is the clue by which I am to be followed into my poor labyrinth. According to my experience, the conventional notion of a lover cannot be always true. The unqualified truth is that when I loved Estella with the love of a man, I loved her simply because I found her irresistible. Once for all, I knew to my sorrow, often and often, if not always, that I loved her against reason, against promise, against peace, against hope, against happiness, against all discouragement that could be. Once for all, I loved her none the less because I knew it, and had no more influence in restraining me than if I had devoutly believed her to be human perfection. I so shaped out my walk as to arrive at the gate at my old time. When I had rung at the bell with an unsteady hand, I turned my back upon the gate, while I tried to get my breath and keep the beating of my heart moderately quiet. I heard the side door open, and steps come across the courtyard. But I pretended not to hear, even when the gate swung on its rusty hinges. Being at last touched on the shoulder, I started and turned. I started much more naturally then to find myself confronted by a man in a sober grey dress, the last man I should have expected to see in that place of porter at Miss Havisham's door. "Orlick? Ah, young master, there's more changes than yours. But come in, come in. It's opposed to my orders to hold the gate open." I entered, and he swung it, and locked it, and took the key out. "Yes," said he, facing round after doggedly preceding me a few steps towards the house. "Here I am." "How did you come here?" "I come here," he retorted, "on my legs. I had my box brought alongside me in a barrow."
"Are you here for good?"
"I ain't here for harm, young master, I suppose."
I was not so sure of that. I had leisure to entertain the retort in my mind while he slowly lifted his heavy glance from the pavement up my legs and arms to my face.
"Then you have left the forge," I said. "Do this look like a forge?" replied Orlick, sending his glance all round him with an air of injury. "Now, do it look like it?"
I asked him how long he had left Gargery's forge.
"One day is so like another here," he replied, "that I don't know without casting it up. However, I've come here some time since you left."
"I could have told you that, Orlick."
"Ah," said he dryly, "but then you've got to be a scholar."
By this time we had come to the house, where I found his room to be one just within the side door, with a little window in it, looking on the courtyard. In its small proportions, it was not unlike the kind of place usually assigned to a gate porter in Paris. Certain keys were hanging on the wall, to which he now added the gate key, and his patchwork-covered bed was in a little inner division or recess. The whole had a slovenly, confined and sleepy look, like a cage for a human dormouse, while he, looming dark and heavy in the shadow of a corner by the window, looked like the human doorhouse for whom it was fitted up, as indeed he was.
"I never saw this room before," I remarked, "but there used to be no porter here."
"No," said he, "not till it got about that there was no protection on the premises, and it come to be considered dangerous, with convicts and tag and rag and bobtail going up and down.
and then I was recommended to the place as a man who could give another man as good as he brought, and I took it. It's easier than bellowsing and hammering. That's loaded, that is.
My eye had been caught by a gun with a brass-bound stock over the chimney-piece, and his eye had followed mine.
Well, said I, not desirous of more conversation, shall I go up to Miss Havisham?
Burn me if I know,
he retorted, first stretching himself and then shaking himself.
My orders ends here, young master. I give this here bell a rap with this here hammer, and you go along the passage till you meet somebody.
I am expected, I believe.
Burn me twice over if I can say, said he.
Upon that, I turned down the long passage which I had first trodden in my thick boots, and he made his bell sound. At the end of the passage, while the bell was still reverberating, I found Sarah Pocket, who appeared to have now become constitutionally green and yellow by reason of me.
"Oh," said she, "you is it, Mr. Pip?"
"It is, Miss Pocket. I'm glad to tell you that Mr. Pocket and family are all well."
"Are they any wiser?" said Sarah, with a dismal shake of the head. "They had better be wiser than well. Matthew, Matthew. You know your way, sir?"
"Tolerably, for I'd gone up the staircase in the dark many a time. I ascended it now, in lighter boots than of yore, and tapped in my old way at the door of Miss Havisham's room.
"Pip's rap,"
I heard her say immediately.
"Come in, Pip."
She was in her chair near the old table, in the old dress, with her two hands crossed on her stick, her chin resting on them, and her eyes on the fire. Sitting near her, with the white shoe that had never been worn in her hand, and her head bent as she looked at it, was an elegant lady whom I had never seen.
"Come in, Pip,"
Miss Havisham continued to mutter, without looking round or up.
"Come in, Pip. How do you do, Pip? So you kiss my hand as if I were a queen, eh? Well?"
She looked up at me suddenly, only moving her eyes, and repeated in a grimly playful manner,
"Well?"
"I've heard, Miss Havisham," said I, rather at a loss, "that you were so kind as to wish me to come and see you, and I came directly."
"Well?"
The lady, whom I'd never seen before, lifted up her eyes and looked archly at me. And then I saw that the eyes were Estella's eyes. But she was so much changed, was so much more beautiful, so much more womanly. In all things, winning admiration had made such wonderful advance that I seemed to have made none. I fancied, as I looked at her, that I slipped hopelessly back into the coarse and common boy again. Oh, the sense of distance and disparity that came upon me, and the inaccessibility that came about her. She gave me her hand. I stammered something about the pleasure I felt in seeing her again, and about my having looked forward to it for a long, long time.
"Do you find her much changed, Pip?"
asked Miss Havisham, with her greedy look, and striking her stick upon a chair that stood between them, as a sign to me to sit down there. "When I came in, Miss Havisham, I thought there was nothing of Estella in the face or figure, but now it all settles down so curiously into the old—"
"What? You are not going to say into the old Estella?"
Miss Havisham interrupted.
"She was proud and insulting, and you wanted to go away from her. Don't you remember?"
I said confusedly that that was long ago, and that I knew no better then than the like. Estella smiled with perfect composure, and said she had no doubt of my having been quite right, and of her having been very disagreeable.
"Is he changed?"
Miss Havisham asked her.
"Very much,"
said Estella, looking at me.
"Less coarse and common?"
said Miss Havisham, playing with Estella's hair. Estella laughed and looked at the shoe in her hand, and laughed again and looked at me, and put the shoe down. She treated me as a boy still, but she lured me on. We sat in the dreamy room among the old strange influences which had so wrought upon me, and I learnt that she had but just come home from France, and that she was going to London. Proud and wilful as of old, she had brought those qualities into such subjection to her beauty that it was impossible, and out of nature, or so I thought, to separate them from her beauty. Truly it was impossible to disassociate her presence from all those wretched hankerings after money and gentility that had disturbed my boyhood, from all those ill-regulated aspirations that had first made me ashamed of home and Joe, from all those visions that had raised her face in the glowing fire, struck it out of the iron on the anvil, extracted it from the darkness of night to look in at the wooden window of the forge and flit away. In a word, it was impossible for me to separate her in the past or in the present from the innermost life of my life. It was settled that I should stay there all the rest of the day and return to the hotel at night and to London tomorrow. When we had conversed for a while, Miss Havisham sent us two out to walk in the neglected garden. On our coming in by and by, she said I should wheel her about a little, as in times of yore. So Estella and I went out into the garden by the gate through which I had strayed to my encounter with the pale young gentleman, now Herbert. I, trembling in spirit and worshipping the very hem of her dress, she, quite composed, and most decidedly not worshipping the hem of mine. As we drew near to the place of encounter, she stopped and said, "I must have been a singular little creature to hide and see that fight that day, but I did, and I enjoyed it very much."
"You rewarded me very much."
"Did I?"
she replied, in an incidental and forgetful way.
"I remember I entertained a great objection to your adversary, because I took it ill that he should be brought here to pester me with his company.
He and I are great friends now."
"Are you? I think I recollect, though, that you read with his father."
"Yes." I made the admission with reluctance, for it seemed to have a boyish look, and she already treated me more than enough like a boy.
"Since your change of fortune and prospects, you have changed your companions," said Estella.
"Naturally," said I.
"And necessarily," she added in a haughty tone. "What was fit company for you once will be quite unfit company for you now."
In my conscience, I doubt very much whether I had any lingering intention left of going to see Joe. But if I had, this observation put it to flight.
"You had no idea of your impending good fortune in those times?"
said Estella, with a slight wave of her hand, signifying in the fighting times.
"Not the least."
The air of completeness and superiority with which he walked at my side, and the air of youthfulness and submission with which I walked at hers, made a contrast that I strongly felt. It would have rankled in me more than it did if I had not regarded myself as eliciting it by being so set apart for her and assigned to her. The garden was too overgrown and rank for walking in with ease, and after we had made the round of it twice or thrice, we came out again into the brewery yard. I showed her to a nicety where I had seen her walking on the casks that first old day, and she said with a cold and careless look in that direction,
"Did I?"
I reminded her where she had come out of the house and given me my meat and drink, and she said,
"I don't remember."
"Not remember that you made me cry?" said I.
"No,"
said she, and shook her head and looked about her. I verily believe that her not remembering and not minding in the least made me cry again inwardly, and that is the sharpest crying of all.
"You must know,"
said Estella, condescending to me as a brilliant and beautiful woman might,
"that I have no heart, if that has anything to do with my memory."
I got through some jargon to the effect that I took the liberty of doubting that, that I knew better, that there could be no such beauty without it.
"Oh, I have a heart to be stabbed in or shot in, I've no doubt," said Estella. "And of course, if it ceased to beat, I should cease to be, but you know what I mean. I have no softness there. No sympathy, sentiment, nonsense. What was it that was borne in upon my mind when she stood still and looked attentively at me? Anything that I had seen in Miss Havisham? No,
In some of her looks and gestures there was that tinge of resemblance to Miss Havisham, which may often be noticed to have been acquired by children from grown persons with whom they have been much associated and secluded, and which, when childhood is past, will produce a remarkable occasional likeness of expression between faces that are otherwise quite different. And yet I could not trace this to Miss Havisham.